I am Adrien Garcia, entrepreneur, designer, and co-founder of the clothing brand Rayoni. And you are listening to The Bold Way. The future belongs to those who question the established order. But how do you reinvent the rules, create iconic projects, and work that will make history? The Bold Way is the podcast that gets into the minds of those who excel in the field. Fashion, entertainment, food, design, art, or business. Their common points? Hard work, boldness, innovation, and a particular focus on creativity and aesthetics. My mission is to dissect their methods and mindset through long and filtered interviews to give you the keys to their success and inspire you to create your own path. The Bold Way is more than just a podcast. It's a movement that encourages everyone to find their own way, carve their own path, and innovate in their field. The Bold Way is where creativity and innovation meets business. Enjoy the episode. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this new episode of The Bold Way. Today, we are going to deep dive into the beautiful world of Tyler Brulé. Hello, Tyler.
Good morning, bonjour.
Bonjour. My intention today, Tyler, is to offer to the audience how to become Tyler, a life and business lesson from Tyler. I'd like to do things a little differently today because I love to make things different. I want to innovate. I've made a small list of words, each one corresponding to a theme I'd like to cover with you. And I propose that you pick a paper and read the word and to kickstart our conversation. Does it sound?
Okay, listen, you're on my turf, so I feel safe playing this game anyway. We should probably set the tone where we are, because we're not in Paris today, are we?
Of course. I wanted to let you know where we are today. And a little disclaimer, yeah, we spent the evening yesterday night together. And thanks again for your warm welcome. Where are we today, Tyler?
We are at Dufourstrasse 90, 90, in the 8th district of Zurich. So we're along the lake in a district called Seefeld. We are standing, which I think is maybe quite unique for you. We're not sitting to do this podcast because we like to stand at this facility here in Zurich. And this is our global headquarters.
Yeah.
So we are on the top floor of this building, but right now you and I are standing downstairs in our broadcasting space.
Yeah, I'm so jealous.
And we have... to me, this sort of serves as the model that we'd like to do in other cities, maybe Paris as well.
Teaser.
And it is it combines a kiosk, it combines our retail, and we have a trunk store next door, and it's really sort of in many ways emblematic of what we've I think tried to do with the magazine for the last 16 years, which is become part of a community. Challenge how a neighborhood works, hopefully contribute to a better neighborhood as well. And we wanted to also bring audio to street level too. So the space that we're standing in on a Sunday morning, or it could be on a Wednesday afternoon or a Thursday evening, oftentimes we're bringing audio to life here as well. But this is home. This is where we're based. And you've got wet hair because we just came from the lake.
Exactly. Thank you for the bath this morning. That was amazing. So no, I want to move to Zurich. I want to live here. That's crazy. Just before we begin and to set the scene, who are you, Tyler?
Who am I? I'm a Swiss resident for going on a little over two decades, but I'm Canadian. Was born in Western Canada, really almost in the geographical center of North America in a place called Winnipeg. So grew up principally in three places in Canada, in Winnipeg and Montreal and Toronto, and spent my first 20 years there, and then went to the UK. I'm a journalist, even though I have my card says other things on it, like chairman or editorial director. But I think in my heart, I still feel I'm a journalist. That's what I do. That is what informs me and the way
is this your training?
Is it my training? I guess in part. I went to journalism school. I didn't last very long because I felt after the first 3 or 4 months of a 3-year program, first, I think you can either write or you can't. There's something in you. Now, of course, you can figure out how to write a good stand first. You can figure out how to create a narrative and do a great intro. But I really felt that after those 3 or 4 months starting, I'd found the tools that I needed, and then I was just a bit frustrated and started doing part-time jobs and started to write or trying to broadcast or do whatever I could, and maybe also to do whatever I could to leave Canada. Mm.
What was your dream at the time?
At the time, if we think back to like back to the mid 80s, I grew up. So you have to think sort of, you know, if the United States is France, then maybe Canada is a bit like Belgium. You know, it has this, you know, complicated relationship with its neighbor. It is a bilingual country, you know, bolted on the side of the United States. And if you think back to the 80s, it was of course a time then of also, you know, what was the big revolution in media in the 80s was the surge of cable television, and that you had this plethora of new TV channels that were on offer. And of course, journalistically, I was always interested in television news because television news really set the agenda at that time. And you could argue that TV news still has, of course, a presence when major events happen. But to me, that was the point of attraction. And I was really, I would say almost fixated that I wanted to go and be a newsreader for a major television network in New York. That was my dream desire. And yeah, there are a couple of ways that, of course, maybe more than a couple of ways you could do that. But you know, one is, of course, you have to leave to make your way back. And I thought, well, maybe I'll go to Australia or I'll go to the UK, cut my teeth in journalism, and then find my way back to North America. But here we are in Zurich. It didn't work out.
You fail.
I failed. So anyway, but nevertheless, along the way, at least I'm able to call myself a journalist, with some confidence.
Yeah, just to set the scene as well. What are your business today? What are you doing?
So we have,
you're doing so many things.
Yeah, we have. But I would say there's two principal things that we do. We have, so as I said, we're sitting or standing in Zurich today. Our holding company has two main businesses. So we have our branding and design agency, Wink Creative, which has been going since 1998. It was a spin-off of a former project when I was editing and founded Wallpaper Magazine. This was, if you think back to, again, to the mid 90s, no one was talking about native advertising. We didn't have this type of collab publicité advertising. It was really the dawn of this, and clients were coming to the magazine and saying, to Wallpaper that is, and saying, oh, we really, you know, we love the illustrator that you found from Japan. You know, could we work with him to potentially illustrate our new football sneaker or new football boots? Could you help us develop a magazine, etc.? And so after a point, we thought it was a bit of a conflict of interest that the magazine was doing all of these things. So we set up a separate business, and it started with two or three people as the creative team behind this agency, which we called Wink. And then it grew from there. So that is one part of our business today. And so when I, you know, parted ways with Time Warner and sold Wallpaper, I kept the agency, and then after a period of time, then we also developed the other part of our business today, which is Monocle, and that is also headquartered here, and so we own 100% of the agency, our holding company, and we own 70% of the magazine, and we have some other family offices and other investors in the business as well.
Fantastic. Thank you. Let's start now this little game.
Okay. Well, you've given me a series of flashcards. I can pick anywhere.
Can pick anywhere.
Okay. I'm going for the middle of the deck.
Yeah.
Okay. I've chosen, I've started with boldness.
That's perfect.
Which is good. Maybe it's a good start for the show. Okay. Boldness. You just want me to reflect on the term?
Yeah. Yeah. What is boldness for you?
Boldness is it's a number of things. I mean, I think if we think about someone being bold, it could often, of course, be shorthand for someone maybe being a little bit outspoken. Occasionally, you can say a bold person could be a little bit rude because their tone or manner is could be seen as aggressive. But of course, boldness as we almost know it today is this. It's about a sense of adventure, and it's about being able to push forward, and it's about having conviction and a belief.
Are you bold?
Am I bold? I think at times I'm not. I'm not always. It depends, probably. Yeah, it depends. Maybe not. Well, in business, I think I feel that, and sometimes maybe over the course of this interview, I won't speak in terms of me, but also we, because it's not just, this business, is what it is because of an amazing team and a great team of people that we've been together for a very, very long time. Some of the principals in this company, we've been together for, almost three decades, which is kind of remarkable, I think, at a time when there is so much turnover in business, et cetera. So I'm very lucky that I have people who've stuck around with me, and we've stuck together for a long period. But so I'd say collectively, I think there's a bit there is a boldness or a sense of the bold to bring certain projects to market, to maybe go in a certain direction when, everyone is heading one way, and maybe we sort of choose to boldly go a completely different way because we think it's right for the market. It's maybe right for the audience that we want to speak to. And I think that, if I look back, there's a number of things that we've done, or there's a number of things that we continue to do and stand by, which have a sense of boldness, given the current state of the media market, the communications market internationally.
Mm. I think you incarnate the boldness, because what's very interesting is you when you start your advertising company, or when you start Wallpaper or Monocle, how do you say it? You say Monocle, right?
How do you say it in French?
Monocle. so you didn't get trained as an advertiser. You learn by yourself, and you learn by doing. This is what impressed me the most, actually, when I look at your career. How do you become an advertiser? How do you become an editor? How do you become a radio tycoon?
Wow, a tycoon. That's exciting. I think you have to be maybe an observant consumer. I think you can become. Maybe a good ad creative or a good branding person, because you pay attention as a consumer to the things that you think work. What attracts you to a brand? What are the elements that make it function? Why does a brand endure? And so I think you have to be able to ask yourself those questions. And I think probably if I think about my just growing up and the forces that were around me, I was always surrounded by a lot of media, a lot of books, a lot of magazines, a lot of comics. That was very much part of my experience growing up. I've always been curious about the world. I've always, I always loved maps and globes, and probably there was a period when I was 7 or 8 where I was probably very annoying, and I think probably knew every capital of every nation in the world, and could really sort of look at a map and without any country names or any capital cities on that map, I would know the nations, and I would know the capital cities. So there's always been this. There was always an interest and a continuing interest in political geography and geopolitics. So I have to. It comes back to just being curious, interrogating things, and I think that if you do that, and if you're an observer, this is not about mimicking things, but you can look at a product and think, how can I make that better? You can read a magazine. If you love magazines, of course, I think you're always fantasizing about. Maybe not everybody, but I certainly had fantasies about how I could do my own project, and it's interesting. Probably somewhere in my basement, in one of the lockups here in Zurich, I would have. There are definitely sort of black folders with cellophane pages where I would, I used to rip things out of City Magazine, out of Le Point, out of Der Spiegel, and I would sort of create this melange of just different pages from magazines from all over the world to think, this is what my dream magazine would look like. And funnily enough, we could probably go back and we could go into the basement and you'd probably see something from 30 years ago, which is not a million miles away from what Monocle's become today. So I think, you know, even there, I think there's probably a sense of, just being able to observe, dissect, and of course, not saying mimic, but I think, of course, I mean, to be inspired by certain things. And I think, how do you think about taking them in a new direction?
Can we become bold? If you're not bold, you won't be bold.
Well, you know, boldness is about taking risk and putting yourself out there, and boldness is an acceptance that you have to be ready to accept that you might fail. Mm. And so I think those forces probably have to. I don't know if you can teach someone to be a risk taker. Maybe not, but I think people can perhaps be conditioned, or you can create a series of circumstances or conditions where maybe people say, "Yeah, I could go for it. What's the worst thing that could happen to me?" So, but I think I do believe that in the same way that you're a born writer, I think that you're either risk averse, or you're ready to sort of jump in and go for it.
It looks. Do you take a lot of risk? Because it looks like when you start a new project, it's always start very small, a side business, and then you just test and learn, and then you grow it.
Yeah, I think that there is. Well, I guess if I think back to the mid '90s. And when I launched Wallpaper, I'd never done anything in business before. I'd never even had a proper talk to a bank manager. I didn't understand the mechanics of how advertising worked. But nevertheless, I had this passion to launch this magazine, and went out and spoke to the bank and spoke to friends and contacts I'd met in the design and fashion industry. To float the idea. And so I guess that there is, there is that moment when you say, look at, I'm going to give up my nicely paid job. At that time I was working for Dow Jones, the TV arm of Dow Jones television, and I'm going to go for it. So there is that cutoff moment where you have to sort of look over the edge and say,
let's go.
This is it, let's do it. Mm. So yeah, and so maybe the starting point was risky, and there was a boldness to that. But then, I think, as you said, as you go along, things just organically start to grow, and you see angles and directions that you can take projects in or take ideas in to develop them.
Mm. Let's take another word.
Let's take another word. Maybe I'm going to go right to the bottom of the pile here. Challenge the status quo. It's a little bit like boldness, but I would say for sure that if I think back, coming on 17 years soon when we launched this project, Monocle, that is, there was a sense then that why are you doing a magazine? Hmm. Even 17 years ago, why aren't you doing something digital? We're not, and speaking to investors, we're not going to put money behind a venture, no matter how good the idea is editorially, that involves paper and the complexity of logistics. Let's think about something which is only digital. So right away there, I feel that we were going against the status quo. We've been for a long time social media skeptics on so many levels, not just about technology, but what is this social media conversation do for society? And is it good for a family-owned media brand to be co-opting and working with, lots of other partners who we see, we see what's happened because of Google and Twitter and all of these other players in terms of what it's done to the advertising market. So I think we've been, again, if everyone sort of ran to a world of social media, we've been, I would say, certainly against the status quo in doing that. And part of that is not driven because we want to be complicated or difficult. Also, it's driven by the realities of also being a small family business, that those are risks you can't take. Mm. So, and I don't know, and that's interesting. I mean, going back to the first word, is there a boldness in not doing it? or I don't know, you could say it's also maybe a foolishness as well for not doing it as well. But so curiously, sometimes I think that that sense of the bold can also be, it's also caught, you know, there's a certain boldness of also being cautious as well, that maybe we don't have to jump in and head in this direction because we see the competition and our potential partners doing the same things. There's a side of also of caution. Let's just sit back and wait. We don't have to be a pioneer. Let other people make mistakes. And then maybe there'll be a moment for us to work with that technology or also to work with that photographer or to work with that brand, whatever it may be. But we don't have to be the first ones there.
Hmm. But you are one of the only one who is not on Instagram, right?
I must be the only person in the world not on Instagram, yeah.
But that's crazy. You can exist without Instagram, and that's a good message.
I don't think it's a message. It's part of it is I don't...
You don't want to produce content for Instagram.
Well, I guess there's two things. I mean, yeah, there's personally, I'm not on Instagram, and I don't... I've seen what's become of a lot of other respected media companies where they've become... Yeah, the vassal, the servant to Instagram, and also the brands that want to be on Instagram. So you have some very respected magazine titles, which have become Instagram production factories now for a luxury goods company. And then, of course, to serve the needs of Instagram as a channel. And I question, well, what does that do for the legacy of that brand? Because they've lost control of the message, but they've certainly lost control of the relationship with their consumer because suddenly it's mediated by Instagram. And I think that's a challenge because we all want to have the relationship with our audience.
Of course.
And I think, it's essential, I think more than ever, that independent media companies maintain that relationship and it's not managed or it's not co-opted through a third party.
If you were a clothing brand or a product brand, would you go on Instagram?
Yes, I think if and you see, of course, it works, or at least I believe it works.
Yeah, there's so many brands who start thanks to Instagram.
Absolutely.
Like Jacquemus and so many.
Yes, and so I think there it's different as well because, you know, I always say whether you're running a salon for cats or you are you're in the business of vintage cars or vintage watches or you're launching a fashion brand, of course Instagram is a great channel. I think it's different if you're a media company though. And I think you have to be very careful because it is a different type of relationship and I think what do we see? It's, you know, in many ways you're feeding your competition. And I think a lot of media companies have waded into not, and it's not just about Instagram, but other social media channels as well, where again, they start to lose that sense of the relationship. And I think also readers and or viewers or listeners who go to these channels, they scroll through Instagram and they think, okay, I've had my Vogue France experience. I've had my Le Monde experience, whatever it is, I actually don't go back to the source because I've had it in bite-sized pieces. So I'm just staying in that channel in the same way that I stay in the same channel because I like this running wear brand. Am I even sort of venturing to their website? No, actually they served me up a pair of, you know, shorts today on their feed. And so that, I think that's the other issue as well, is sometimes that people are just skimming all of these brands and there's never this development of a deeper relationship. And I think particularly from a media perspective as well, I might go and listen to a clip or see an image on Instagram, but then do I go and look at the deeper story?
No. If you were me, you would go away from Instagram?
So I know more about your media business since we were chatting over the last 18 hours or so, and the conversation that we had before the red lights went on for this broadcast. Maybe it's more a case of weaning yourself off of it, and I think this is the challenge because going back to the earlier point, you're having to sort of feed this beast. And is that a distraction then? Because again, you're feeding a beast which you don't own. It might drive traffic to you, but there's only, you know, a limited number of hours in the day, and there aren't 100 of you. So does it also become a bit of a distraction too, when you want to be able to, of course, do other things? And yet sometimes you feel I've got to also keep this thing alive as well. So yeah, I think there's an aspect of distraction and then not focusing on what is your core.
So how did you acquire new clients, new audience?
Well, we walked into this space a few minutes ago with you, and as I said, we're at street level in Zurich, and I don't think there were any empty tables outside. Everybody is here on, of course, it's a beautiful morning, high summer, and people are outside enjoying coffees and orange juices and croissants, etc. So I would, in many ways, this is one part of many things that we do, but this is about being face to face with our audience and having conversations and meeting people and listening to feedback and just also, again, just observing who's our customer. Is it a couple who don't live in Zurich who are visiting from Chicago? The family from up the lake who are Swiss, or they're expats? But the great thing is that you're able to find out all of these things, because you either look at license plates or you overhear conversations. But most importantly, you go and talk to people. That's I would say one part of our acquisition strategy has been since the very beginning to do a lot of events, book signings, product launches, rosé parties, just because it happens to be, you know, the start of summer. And we've really believe in the power of face-to-face. I would say the other thing that we did very early on, 14 years ago, 15 years ago, you know, I think we were among the very first traditional, let's say monthly print businesses that launched a podcast, which was the Monocle Weekly, and that was a conversation in a very nice studio out the back of the BBC, BBC's broadcasting house, and we wanted even then to bring a conversation to the table with our, you know, obviously amongst our editors, but bring that out to our audience. That was obviously a very early way. I would say it was created more as a promotion tool. It wasn't really there to be. It was, I would say, the very, very early days is, this is what we're up to. This is what Monocle is doing. And it was talking to that correspondent, and it was speaking to that photographer. How did they shoot that story? And it was there as a promotional tool. Then, of course, we've had the dawn of newsletters. And I think we've also been there at the forefront very, very early on. Again, slightly in a more promotional space, and then moving into something which is 100% editorial. Sure, there are moments where we promote across it. I would say maybe the issue, though, is we haven't stepped out of our own channels very, very often. There is a feed on Twitter, which is where we promote what's on radio, but we're not engaging on Twitter.
Okay.
It's there as just as
you
a
push. Yeah.
It's just, this is what we're doing. Tune into this program, etc. But we're not having a conversation on Twitter. It's one way, and I think that's very much the part of
the promotion. Yeah.
Yeah, the promotion, but I think it's also a little bit the spirit of, you know, and it could be right, could be wrong, but I don't believe that all conversations need to be public, and not everything needs to be shared. And if you disagree with something or you love something that we do, you can go to the masthead of the magazine, or you can go to our website and you can find everyone's address. And if you want to have a conversation with our editor in chief, Andrew, or if you didn't like the way a page was organized, or you don't like the size of the typography, or you love that illustrator that we commissioned from Japan, then you can write to our creative director, and we will respond. I think that's, there's a certain, I guess, elegance, discretion, which is in many ways the way we function, which is also why we don't want to be in this shouty, show-off world that has become I would say, one of the pillars of so much of social media. Mm. I can respond to you in my own time, but hopefully in a timely manner to whatever your comment is. And it doesn't have to be broadcast everywhere. And I said, that could be right or wrong, that approach. Maybe we should be on lots of social media channels, trumpeting ourselves more. But what I would prefer to see, though, is I would like to see ourselves and promoting our business in a way which is maybe a little bit more traditional, great advertising, out of home cinema advertising. Fantastic digital campaigns in other channels would be interesting for us. I often think about, you know, what would Monocle look like if it had, you know, an extra 10 million euros to spend on an amazing brand campaign. And then I think that something we'd like to look at. We don't have 10 million to do it, but maybe there's half a million.
Fantastic. Let's speak another word.
Okay, we go to the top of the pile. Make it easy. Aesthetic.
Aesthetic, yeah.
So I think that that's an interesting one because it cuts across both parts of our business. Certainly, people who come to our agency for a solution, who want to launch a new brand, who want to develop a strategy around an existing brand, they're coming to us because we have an aesthetic. There is a way we photograph, there is a way that we will lay out a page, there is a way that we will create a narrative for a brand. And again, this is something which has its, you know, I guess has its opportunities and challenges. People come to you because, you know, they know what they're going to get. Of course, hopefully we're able to challenge them and push ourselves and push the client. That goes beyond obviously something that they saw in one of our publications or on our website. And certainly, yeah, there's no question that there is an aesthetic to Monocle typographically, from an illustration point of view, the way we do a fashion story as much as the way we will go to Syria and shoot a story as well. And even in the meeting that we're in right now, I think that there is an audio aesthetic too, that even the way we want to create our environments, I think people perform better. If you're surrounded by nice materials, I think there's nothing worse than going to a radio studio and it's all bright and it's white and it's all hard surfaces and you already have the headphones on and it already sounds rubbish. And there's too much activity going on. And so I think it's also, even there, it's, I think, creating a sense of calm and I used the terms earlier, but we want to be good hosts. We want to be good hosts on radio. We want to be good hosts to the people coming for a coffee. I want to be a good host for her brand who might want to work with us. And that's you know, that aesthetic approach starts with the person working at reception at Midori House in London. It's about the way the coffee is going to be served. And the way they will leave the meeting as well, and whether that's with print in a nice tote bag, but there's an approach and a way that we and a level of detail that we want to bring to things, which is hopefully runs through everything that we do. We don't get it right all the time, but I'm quite proud of the fact that 85% of the time we somehow get there.
You're not bad. How do you describe your aesthetic? What's the DNA? Because honestly, I don't say that to give you too much compliments, but this is very different. You know, when you enter this place, this coffee shop, and this shop, it feels very different. And you there's nothing comparable to that aesthetic. How did you build it? How did you curve it?
So, well, it's interesting. Let me ask you, why does it feel different to you? Because this is interesting to. I think what we have created is sure doesn't look like other places, but what are the cues that you experience?
I think I think this is the material, the feeling, the atmosphere, the attention to detail, the wood everywhere, the carpet. all those little details that make the difference, actually. You know, it's like when you enter a bully, Officine Universelle Bully Shop, I mean, there is attention to detail every single everywhere. So it feels different. It looks like you are traveling in the 50s, in the 60s. There's something like that. Yeah.
So, well, maybe part of it has been informed by an interest in mid-century modernism, and that's graphics. That's of course industrial design. It is furniture. And all of the trappings that go around it. So, and that means that there's definitely an appreciation for Scandinavian design, and not just from the 50s and 60s, but also from a contemporary perspective. We're in Switzerland, of course, probably arguably the home of the most outstanding modern typography and graphic design. And the Swiss grid, the way words and images are organized on a page or on a screen today, comes from here. And then, of course, a great tradition of materials in Switzerland as well. And probably it's also informed by the I would say on the detail side, just really an obsession over the last 25 years with Japan, and having spent so much time in Japan. Developing our business, working with partners, and just constantly, and being probably a great consumer of all things Japanese as well. So it's probably a blend of all of these things that come together, and that it's we work with architects, but we are also demanding, and I would and certainly we're clients. Who know what they want as well. So maybe to your point or your observation, it's not driven. I'd say our the aesthetic of our built environment is not driven by the hand of one architect, or that we gave the contract to one or two furniture companies.
Mm. It's driven by you.
Yes, it is. That goes back to the client side, and then I think also informed by the other thing too. I think is probably just hopefully informed by a sense of, and I go back to that idea of being well hosted. That just creating also something which is comfortable. It's not about having an environment which is in a contemporary sense has been designed for social media and photography. It's an area where we want people to linger if they are guests, if they're colleagues and employees, that it's a place where people have a level of comfort and they feel welcome. And I mean it sounds a bit trite to use the word cozy, but we do, we've done a book about cozy homes, and we do want to create cozy environments. And okay, there's a lot of technology where we're standing right now, but yeah, there's a sense of coziness to this as well. That okay, it works on a nice summer's day, but it also feels actually okay when it's a gray Sunday morning in February too.
Mm, cool.
Let's pick another word. We'll go back to the middle. I'm going back to the bottom. Yeah. The bottom third of the pile. Network. Interesting. So many places we can go with that. What do you want out of it when you think about network?
No, this is coming back to a question I asked you yesterday night. You know, it looks like you are the perfect networker. My question about networking is how do you network? You know, how do you built this huge network all over the world, and how did it help you to build your business and or to become a good networker? Actually, this is a very personal question. Actually, you know, it sounds like for me, I'm not a good networker. You know, I interviewed like 300 people, more than 300 people, and you know, I'm struggling to get to keep in touch with them, you know, and to build the network. How did you do that?
So Instagram doesn't help you?
No.
I think it's listen, I sit here sometimes as well, and I'll think, how could I be better at maintaining both personal relationships and professional relationships, and also those relationships that are in between that that might move from the personal to the professional, or and vice versa. But saying thank you is important. And I think the importance of the follow up is essential. And I'm always amazed how many people forget to say thank you. And really, that sense of recognition that you took someone out for dinner, or you helped them, with a job interview, whatever it is, and there's no response or no thank you. So I think that I'm always keen to make sure that, and that's not about maintaining a dialogue. It's just simple courtesy. But I think simple courtesy often opens up many more doors to, of course, have a conversation, to be able to have a forwarding relationship, with a potential writer or photographer who we might work with, as much as it could be an advertiser or someone who might be a potential investor in our business someday. So I would say remembering to say thank you is one thing which is key, and then I think there's other aspects of follow up too. I think there are some really basic things, like I'm amazed how many people don't have a business card anymore. We don't have a business card because our company's trying to save the environment. As if printing 100 business cards is going to change the state of where the world is heading or where the world is at the moment. But I think it is simple things like that, which where maybe many months later someone finds your card and something has been triggered, and you haven't corresponded with them since, but they do come back to you. And then it's but of course, I travel a lot, and so there's a I would say the fundamental in this is being out in the world, and I like to go out. I like a good dinner. I love a good drink. I like good bars, so I love entertaining people, and probably that has been I'm not saying a part of our success, but that sense of going back to a city, having met somebody and just saying, hey, let's go to the Park Hyatt for a drink this evening. Let's go and have a coffee and let's see where this goes. Because you mentioned you have a relationship with this government agency in Australia. Why don't we revisit that conversation? And so there, I think it's the genuine excitement of the power of human connection, and being with people. Mm. And I think networks are also built by listening as well. And there are many people who are great at selling themselves. But of course, you have to, if you're going to sell, no matter what channel you're going down, you also have to. You need someone on the other side who's also a good listener, as well. You need to be a good interrogator too. But I think that combination of being receptive and open and analyzing, and of course asking the right questions and being legitimately interested, is also a way of building out a meaningful network. And I guess. Yeah, not doing it consciously. I am always amazed because, you've got like an interesting network, or I'm trying to build my network. I can't say I've never tried. It's just
natural.
Yeah, it's because like, you want to be the life of the party.
It's like a second nature to you. But honestly, I've been very impressed. Oh, you welcome me, at the train station. You pick me to the restaurant. We've been for a bath this morning. I mean, you're so busy and you take the time. I don't know if you did it because I'm a kind of journalist and you wanted to please me, but do you do it with everybody coming to Zurich?
Yeah, I picked my mom up at the airport. So I didn't pick you up by car. So when we walked, but I think that that sense of hosting and looking after people has. Yeah, it's always been, I guess, part of how I was brought up, and even an extension beyond that is probably time spent in Japan and also learning and seeing how the Japanese do it best. I think you can take many cues from Thailand as well. But so I would say also these places have also maybe helped me sort of enhance my sense of hospitality, and things that I've also wanted to, of course, even push within my company, that I'm sure we don't get it again. We don't nail it every time, but I, you know, one of the things I've always liked, certainly in Japan, is that a meeting never ends at the door of an office, that you're on the 15th floor, that you're always escorted to the elevator, that there's a proper sense of departure, and that you're sent off in the right way as much as you're sort of welcomed in the right way. And these are things that that are key. And I'm always amazed, though, how often in certain businesses that you can have a great meeting, but then suddenly the farewell is just flat. And I'm not saying it needs ceremony, but to me, that there are certain rituals and codes which are important in terms of how we conduct as humans. It has nothing to do with business, but just being decent to people.
Mm. And if
what I'm saying is, you're not so special after all. Me.
What did you learn it? You know, and if I don't have this code, where can I learn it?
Yeah, I think it's by absorption and just watching, and also thinking, why did I feel good about that meeting? Why did I feel good about that company? What were they doing as a business, where it's still with me 3 days later, that I've thought about the conversation that I might have had with that CEO or that marketing director. What was it about the lobby of their building, and what was it about the follow up or the farewell that stuck out in my mind? And I think it's absorbing and analyzing those things. I'm always I say to maybe particularly, well, not just younger staff. I think obviously we're all glued to our phones all the time.
On Instagram.
Oh, exactly. We're always on Instagram. But I think one of the most important things that you can do is when you arrive in a city, and particularly when I'm traveling with colleagues who are new to the business, you're in the back of a car, you've landed at an airport in Southeast Asia, and of course everyone's wanting to check their phones. Like, put your goddamn phone down, look out the window. Don't look at your phone. It's like, what are you seeing on the drive from Changi Airport into the center of Singapore? Ask yourself all of these things. Look at the landscaping. Look at the signage on the highways. Is there out of home advertising? Is there not? We just came from Bangkok. Look at all of the massive billboards. Why aren't there any in Singapore? Is this a detraction from the urban environment? Is it an addition? Query, query, query all the time. That doesn't matter whether someone's a strategist in our business or a project manager, or they are in charge of commissioning illustrations, or they're there to win advertising. It's this sense of just absorbing and being in the environment. And this goes back to what you're saying. It's like, how can you learn it? I think it's just by being alert and paying attention. Hmm. And I think it is about getting off the screen. It's like, God, you're in a new vibrant city. What is this giving you? And here I'm holding up a phone, listeners. What is the screen giving you in that moment when you are, in the middle of what is a dynamic economy, which is growing at 6%? Look around. And again, you're not going to have all the answers there, but maybe by the time you get to the dinner that evening with your potential client or people who live locally, you'll have a series of things to ask them. I want to know why is this place constructed the way it is, and who are the laborers on the side of the road? What's happening with migration? Whatever it may be, and I think that sort of sense of curiosity is sometimes missing.
Curiosity, another one. Yeah,
hopefully it's not curiosity. Leader.
That's a good one.
Yeah, it's a good one. So I lead a business, but I also think about leader as well as a term. Leader being, of course, the headline and the packaging of the top of a story as well is a leader too, and when I looked at that word, the first thing I thought about was the technical term sort of in journalism of a leader, and that's also important because that is literally the shorthand as to why I want to read that story. Why do I want to listen to that podcast? Why do I want to go into that store? Why do I want to potentially venture onto that website to buy those shorts? There's something about the leader that I might get an email that is going to be that point of attraction, that point of connection. So yeah, there's two parts of it. I look at that word in a very sort of technical way, because it's a huge part of getting the leader right, to pull someone into an experience, to pull someone towards a brand, to get them to read a story is important. And then, of course, being a leader of a business, of course, is maybe what you're interested in. It's an interesting one because I'm not crazy about the word leadership. And partly because I know because it's become a little bit, there's a certain type of management speak about it, the lead team, the leadership team. And I'm not keen on the word management either. I'm not sure why, but anyway. Mm.
Because you are at the head of, you've got 200 collaborators or employees. I don't know what term do you prefer. How do you show the way? How do you show the path? How do you train them? I mean, what do you give them? How do you make sure they progress? How do you bring them on board? Because to do what you are doing, you need to be very inspiring for your employee and show the way. So,
and I think showing the way is probably the core of it. It's leading by example.
Yeah, example, of course.
Which of course is sometimes easier said than done. But I do believe it is the best way that people can observe. And if you're training somebody up, that they see how you interact with others, and they see how responsive you are, and they see that maybe responsiveness generates more business, or it creates and delivers a better magazine because you're able to turn things around at speed. So to me, that is the most important aspect of it. And I think that is also why I'm a huge believer leading by example and being together, being in a newsroom environment, being in a creative studio. All of these things are important to be physically together as well. I think it's very hard to lead by example. I think this is the challenge of our time, to lead across a screen, to try to lead a company over Zoom. More power to anybody who can do that. But I think people are only succeeding because you already had an existing cultural framework within your company that was maybe strong before. But I really believe I have to understand by seeing you top to toe and watching how you work in a room and how do you relate to your clients, etc. So how do you deal with customers in a cafe? Mm. And I think these are the important points. That if you don't, if I was not, if people saw that I wasn't that concerned about what goes onto the page of the magazine, what type of magazine would we have? Okay, fine. I'm the principal owner of the business. Mm. But if I was just, there to watch it come through the door, but not comment on it, as it evolves, well, on one side, I'm on the hook. It's also my fault. This is, it's a business which I own. And if I have an input somehow, then what comes off the printed press is in part my responsibility as well. And again, you have to, my editors and my colleagues, they have to, I think, recognize that I'm as invested literally as they are in the project.
Hmm. How do you make sure that every single employee feel the, because you've got offices You've got offices all around the world. You cannot see them every single week, every single month. Or you make sure that they are seeing you. You know, they see what you are doing on a daily basis. Or do you make sure everybody feels it? Yeah.
Part of it is trying to get out there as much as possible. And that's not just me, of course. That's my other colleagues. Part of it is also making sure that people who are within that global network are also coming back to home base, that they're in London, that they're in Zurich, that they're also interacting with their colleagues face to face in person. And that is something that we do. And I think it's, you know, in a couple of weeks' time, we have an event in Italy at our store in Merano in Sud Tirol, and there it's also getting people who are not frontline colleagues to also come to that event and to meet the readers and to meet the, they're not just readers, they're the listeners, and they are the shoppers, and they're the cappuccino sippers, etc. But they have to come meet our audience, and this is absolutely essential as well, because I think there is this disconnect often between, you know, the customer, and the customer is very far away, I think, in lots of organizations, and you have no idea whether you're sometimes selling soap or you are running a radio station. Yeah, you could talk about who your core demographic is, but have you really met that person who is making the commute every day from Toulon to Marseille, listening to your radio show? Have you really spoken to the man or woman who's buying your hand soap? And they don't just exist on a PowerPoint chart. And so I think that this is the other, I think, component for us, is that whenever and where possible, we try to get our team to familiarize themselves, of course, with the end customer.
Okay, let's change topic.
I'm still going for the middle bit. Convince. So I guess you're looking here for convincing people to
buy your stuff.
To invest, to take to advertising, to
work with you.
Yeah. I always think there's a fine line between, especially when you've built something over a period of time, and this is not a smugness or an arrogance, but I think you only need to go so far to convince. Hopefully, after a decade and a half, plus of building this, we don't have to do too much convincing. Of course, we have to make the phone calls. We have to try to persuade somebody to come on to a program. But there's also a point of pride as well. Look at if you don't believe it, if it's not right for you, then maybe this is we're not the right forum. And that's whether you're a photographer we want to work with, or you are a model we'd like to put in our fashion story, or maybe you're a brand as well that we think would be great as an advertiser. But, you know, there comes a point as well I'm not going to jump through that many hoops, because we have a compelling audience. We invest in journalism. We have what we believe is a great product. So there's only so far I can go to convince you that this is right. And if you can't see that, then I need to spend my time and effort, of course, talking to people who are maybe a little bit more like-minded. As great as I think that brand might be, but their strategy might be something else, or there might be a misunderstanding about it. In the same way as you can only convince so many readers or listeners to come to you as well. But you have to make sure in that path to get there that that your words are succinct, and that your tone is correct, and that you're hitting the mark in trying to, of course, convince them that Monocle is the right media vehicle for them, or the Monocle jacket that we did with Arpento from Lyon is the right blazer that they need for summer, or that our agency is the right one to reinvent their chocolate brand.
Are you a good, I guess, but I mean, when you are speaking with Chanel or Louis Vuitton or airline company, etc., you need some negotiation at some point, no? you need to, how do you negotiate at this level?
When it comes to negotiation, often I'm in the background. So I'm rarely at the, let's say, at the technical side of closing a deal that is down to
your salesperson,
my publisher, you know, our associate publisher, it's our COO who's going over the contracts, etc. But am I in the background saying, you know, we feel convinced that this is the fees that that we demand for this project because of the editorial investment that already goes into the magazine, the targets that we need to hit, the precedence of how we've dealt with other brands with similar projects. These are the numbers that we need. But I would say the end deal, the agreeing that final number and all of the parameters that go with having to deliver that, that's done by somebody else.
Okay,
I'm usually the opening act.
You are the artist.
I'm the opening act, and then someone else is usually doing the closing and the gritty details. Mm. And that's a part of details I can admit I'm not good on. Looking at endless contracts and let's say the fine detail that's not my strength. Mm.
How do you put a finger? How do you put a figure on a service?
There's a rate card. There is a page rate for the magazine. There is a page rate. Whether it's an hourly rate across a number of weeks to do a podcast or to develop a series with us. There is hours that are billed and built around constructing a proposal because you might be a client who wants to do a book with us. There is a framework to make it happen. I thought you were saying, when you said finger rather than figure, it's not just sort of licking your finger and putting it in the wind and guessing a price. Maybe once upon a time it used to be like that, but we've become a bit more professional now.
Mm. Let's take another word.
Okay. We are going for the word progress. Progress.
What did you progress?
progress. If I think, you know, well, there's like, I think personal progression, sometimes you get to a point where you think, okay, can you go any further? Can you improve? Are you at your best? I'm sure there's often times you think, okay, this is it. We're not going to, are we going to launch a new magazine? Are we going to progress by adding another part to it? Is already a very broad business base if we look at the magazine business. But of course, I mean, at the same time, you know, we have to progress every single day. And every time I listen to a broadcast that we do, or I look at a book or magazine that comes in, I always think there's room to push things forward. And that is part of, you know, I guess why it says editorial director on my card. I'm there to, you know, I've been working with Andrew Tuck, our editor-in-chief, since the launch. I've known him for, you know, almost three decades. But there is still that sense that I think we both want to challenge each other, and I'm there to inspire and not just him, but I mean the whole team to just keep on pushing things. And that is, you know, listen, you know, great broadcasts and great magazines, of course, have a series of codes, and there is repetition. And I think we, you know, I think I understand very well that, you know, that you might love a certain columnist and you like a certain photographer. So there's things which are core to what we do. But then I think there always has to be an aspect of surprise and elevation that happens in everything that we do. And probably annoying in terms of coming back from a place and saying, here's a new illustrator. You know, I want to work with this team, or this is, did you read this piece in the NZZ or in Les Echo this morning? Why didn't our person in Madrid get this story? And I think that is a point of progress that has to happen every single day. Editorial environments.
Do you have a coach?
No, you
don't do that kind of things. What I found very interesting yesterday night, when you told me that at each issue of Monocle, you ask somebody to come to the team and not destroy, but comment on the on the articles.
Yeah. No, it's not every single issue that we've done this, but yeah, this idea of the Blattkritik, the page critic, this something which is very much part of the sort of Germanic newsroom, which I think is, and it's something I want to reinstate further, not because we're approaching two decades of doing the magazine, but maybe as well because there is, you know, tensions that can happen because, of course. Yeah, I mean, we normally do a postmortem anyway, but it's internally that we look back through the issue. What could have been better? You know, everything from was that really, could that story have used two or three more pages just to breathe? Were the photos used in the best way? Should that advertising have sat against that? The opening of that story, does that, publicité, the advertorial that we designed, did it really hit the mark? So I think we do that anyway. But of course, sometimes there are things that an outsider can say that no family and political upset, you may not say it to your team because you just think, okay, it's not worth the fight today. But you know, it's staring you in the face, and sometimes you need that reality. And that's the importance of also having a dialogue with readers, whether your ideas are validated and celebrated and complimented on because someone really, they love, how you approached a certain topic. Maybe it's a very touchy topic, and vice versa, that they remind you that actually you're off the mark here, or they bring you back to center, which I think is sometimes really important. And they say, actually, you know what, the way you approach that story, you guys, you missed it. There is a different way of looking at this topic. And I think that's when it hurts sometimes. And again, in a good way, it just makes everyone smarten up and say, God, that reader really nailed it. And you know what, we need to be better.
What's the final destination? Where do you want to bring this business? What would be your dream final?
It's funny. If you go back to the word network, I would, we're standing obviously in an audio space. I would like to, I think there's a real opportunity to do more with audio and radio. And I think we're at a point right now where, many podcasts have fallen by the wayside. We've seen, certainly with a lot of traditional radio networks and government broadcasters, they're cutting back, and most broadcasters are there to have either a franchise model. So I can listen to Energy Radio in Paris, and I can listen to Energy Radio in Zurich. 80% the same playlist. I mean, I might get Clara Luciani a little bit more in France, and I'm going to get Luca Henny more in Switzerland, but it's largely the same playlist, and it's the same jingles. So is that global as a radio network? It's maybe a global brand, or it's a European brand. But is anyone having a proper international conversation to, let's say, a monocle audience, to an audience which is mobile, and people who are living in multiple cities, and people who might have moved their life from one country to the next and then on to another? You could say that Radio France International, the BBC, Deutsche Welle, there are people who are somewhat in that game, but oftentimes there is a political agenda around it, that the BBC has a role to speak to the Indian subcontinent. The BBC has a role to speak to Africa. And it's a different tone of voice, which is a different type of coverage. And I think that we have an opportunity to do something which is much more in line of obviously what we're doing at the magazine day in and day out. And how do we build that? So I would like to see that this medium grows, expands, that we can be much more that source that doesn't matter where you are, that you happen to be in Toulouse or you're in Toronto, and we are the audio source for you. And it's complemented by a great magazine that is there monthly. It is complemented by fantastic books. One thing I would like to do, let's see where things end up, and maybe this is where I could complement the radio side of things very well globally. I would still like to do a weekly newspaper globally. I think that to do a daily, I mean, I think we've moved on from the world of the daily, and we see the power, of course, that newsletters can have. But is there room to challenge the New York Times at the weekend, to challenge the Financial Times at the weekend? I think so.
And Le Monde as well.
And maybe Le Monde as well. And I think that's interesting. I mean, you've seen Le Monde, of course, pushing into English. You see the NZZ down the street, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung here in Switzerland, very great, very good newspaper. Mm. They've done a big push into Germany and in the German language, but also they have an English language newsletter now as well. And I think as people see there's revenue opportunities, there's and it could be fascinating to see, you know, could we end up with someone having a new global English language brand that's actually not from an English speaking nation. Why not? But there is maybe there's a certain passion, and a certain love of newspapers. And I think the weekend newspaper has become something now very different. I mean, you look at Le Monde and M Le Monde, and you look at, you know, How to Spend It as part of the Financial Times. You know, there's money there. There's revenue there. There's a reason why, you know, How to Spend It has gone from what used to be 9 issues a year to what is it going to be, 39 issues now. Why do you do 39 issues of a supplement of a magazine? Because it makes money. Mm. You're not doing it for the good of your health, which is also, you know, proof that print is still very relevant to certain ad categories. But at the same time, it's very relevant to a constituency of reader as well.
Mm. What do you want to leave to the world?
Well, hopefully, some full shelves of great titles, be they magazines or books or newspapers. I think right now we have a role and I think an opportunity to, and we see this, with our listeners and our readers, that people find a way to us, and they find a relationship with us in terms of how we speak to them. I think people like that we're quite pragmatic. We have a common sense approach to how we look at topics. We have a common sense approach to how we also ignore topics as well. There's many things we don't wade into because it's getting so much noise elsewhere that actually you come to Monocle because we're going to take you somewhere else because there's so much energy around a certain topic. Like, so tech is a very good example. Sometimes people say, oh, it's like, you know, it'd be great if you were doing technology startups more and you were covering that scene. But I mean, that is everywhere. You know, I can go to the pages of The Economist is going to have something on tech. You know that the AI story, the ChatGPT story, is going to be told very well by The Economist. Unless we have something really new to bring to the topic, or something which is really out of left field, where it surprises people, like, okay, that's I didn't expect that. And if Monocle can deliver and do that, great. But there are certain things that we don't have to do either, because it's just not right for our brand.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel responsible for spreading ideas
Absolutely, and both, you know, both a positive responsibility and I would say the responsibility, whether it's a moral responsibility, for sure, and that's something that we think about all the time. And there's, you know, and I would say, you know, here we are standing in a city which is globally respected, not just by us but by other media outlets as one of the most livable cities in the world. And that is, you know, I think informed a big part of the Monocle conversation, with regard to how we want to influence, you know, mayors and property developers, how we think about our neighborhoods, how we think about the future of tall buildings, how we think about an aging society. All of these things, and that the sense of good urbanism is definitely a Monocle message. And there are many topics within that. That we want to be known for and to provoke people.
Hmm. Speaking of the one.
Start over. So if I had to do it all again, or?
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. I guess if I think about education, would I have stuck around in university a bit longer had I just decided to do German or zoology or something else, and maybe not go into journalism. It could have taken me somewhere different. But if I sort of look back at the products and the projects that we've launched, and the various initiatives that we've mounted over the years, and of course the people I've met and the experience that I've had, I think there's not much I would do differently. I mean, of course, there's mistakes along the way that.
What have been the biggest mistake, I think, according to you?
Biggest mistakes. I mean, I think there's. I can't think of any, you know, any massive, massive mistakes which maybe didn't have a sort of a positive, you know, a positive turn. I always sometimes look at this kind of fork in the road moment. When I was in Afghanistan in the mid 90s, to me that was very much a turning point moment. And I can remember very distinct, like seriously fork in the road, that I had a choice to go left or right. And I wanted to go left, and I listened to everyone else, and they said, "Let's go right." And then we ended up getting, we ended up in an ambush, and two of us ended up getting shot. Now that was a mistake, and I should have been more vocal, and maybe I wouldn't have been. Both me and Sabur, my interpreter, wouldn't have been shot, but I'm here, and. Yeah, so this was...
What did this experience change in your life? Would you have done all of this if you wouldn't have got shot?
No, this is the point. So I think the net out of this is... it
gives you the drive.
Yeah, and interesting, I think it also, it makes you a little more, it makes you a little bit more fearless, perhaps. In some ways, I mean, I'm very conscious of my personal safety. Maybe that's why I'm in Zurich. But then I think when it comes to, you know, to business, I'm more of a risk taker, probably because of it, because you've been through something quite traumatic, and you're almost killed, and you think, okay, well, it creates a very different lens in terms of how you look at things. And sure, and I don't think, you know, I could have had that not happen, had that incident not happened, and I would have just come back, and I would have had a successful story, and I would have sold it to, you know, other news organizations. I would have probably just continued to maybe have a successful, you know, career as a freelancer, as a foreign correspondent, and who knows, maybe it would have fulfilled my dream of being the newsreader that I always wanted to be. That if I would have stayed on that path, as opposed to, being in an incident, in a way they're having to start over, partly because of the forces of. Yeah, just not wanting to do journalism the same way, and also seeing an opportunity at that point in the mid 90s to launch Wallpaper. There was a glaring gap in the newsstand. I said, this is a magazine that I should go and, you know, I should go out and do. And maybe this is that sense of, you know, all the words we've been looking at. I felt that there was just this moment in time that I had to go and do this, and probably. Had I not been through the Afghanistan experience, I would have maybe I wouldn't have had the courage to do it.
Do we have to go through this to
you don't have
successful?
To get you don't have to get shot, but I think a jolt is a good thing sometimes.
Yeah.
It creates a moment of clarity and that clarity, of course, opens your eyes to whether it's opportunities or it's a change in course, etc. Don't think it doesn't have to be that dramatic. But
no, but how do you artificially make that kind of experience? You know, to make sure to step back and to make sure you are on the right path and this is the right thing you should do.
Yeah, well, there I think in whether it's artificial, but I think it is having maybe. I guess a sense of self-awareness and maybe having the right, then you have to have the right people around you whose counsel you trust and they can challenge you. Now, is it the same type of jolt?
No.
No, of course not. But yeah, it's probably the next best thing that you can have to a health crisis, a bankruptcy in your business, where you're really, staring down the path at something which looks quite bleak. Mm. So I think that is, to me, that is, it's hard to engineer, and I know that's why we're standing here today, because I mean, maybe who knows, I would have gone off to write a great book or something else as a result of that experience, but it took me somewhere else.
All right. Let's take another one.
Make money. So yes, we need to make money, to do what we do, to reinvest, every day.
And how do you make money?
We make money if I look at our two businesses. So, you know, of course, the running the agency, it's a classic drive to, of course, always have new clients, new projects. And it's a hunting business. And you're always out there. It's a hunting business, but I wish we were out there hunting more, because, we're also in a hosting and reception business, as well. And I also feel that, a lot of it is also people walk into our lobby, you know, metaphorically and physically every day, because they want to work with us. They've seen a property project we've done. They've seen how we've developed, or they've heard how we've developed a strategy for a country, whatever it may be.
What's your specialization? Why they come to you?
I think on the brand side, I think because we come from an editorial background, we're not from a world of advertising. It's not the school of Maurice Levy. it's something very different, and it comes from an editorial world. It comes from a world of news and how do you deliver a narrative? And, you know, everyone talks about storytelling, which is just such an overused term now. It's storytelling is this new shorthand, but I think that's what good ad campaigns have always done, that excellent branding has always been about telling a story. But somehow this gets bolted on as like this new must have. Well, it was always essential as part of it. And I think, And I don't think we've been lucky, because that's what we do. That's what we do as journalists. So I'm not saying that everyone in our agency is a journalist, but there is a certain relationship. There's a certain way, again, of interrogating a project that happens when you're part of a news editorial framework. I think also there's a level of speed, and there is also an understanding. I mean, we work at the top level. We're working in a luxury premium space. We're working at the top level of government. And I think many of the people who are in the agency at a principal level have met heads of state. They know CEOs of luxury businesses. They're also consumers themselves. It's not like I have to sit at a desk and try to understand the business dynamics of Loro Piana versus Brunello Cucinelli versus a new emerging brand from Mongolia. No, actually, I'm a customer of those brands. You know, as someone working in the agency, I understand these codes, and I think that's important, because so oftentimes it's yes, you know, you've got someone from an agency doing a lot of desk research, doing a lot of benchmarking, but are they living it and experiencing it? And I think that experience is a big part of it. On the magazine side, we make money. 60% of our revenues are driven by advertising, by our partnership relationships. 20% is driven by people having an abonnement, going to the newsstand to buy a book, to people subscribing, and the other 20% is retail, and that is. buying ceramics or a jacket or a porter bag or one of the pieces of luggage that you were looking at when you walked in. It used to be a bit of a funny, strange part of our business because, you know, it was less than 10%. It was, you know, 6-7% of our turnover as recently as a few years ago. And it's really grown. Not easy, but it's now almost, it's too big a part of our business to ignore. And in fact, it's a part of our business that we're actively going to look at expanding and how can we offer more products for our audience.
Yeah. What's the fil rouge of all your business?
I would say the red line across everything we do, it's about quality. That there should be a story. It all starts with a story, and it has to be a compelling one. That's why you're going to stay listening to one of our programs when you're listening to Monocle Radio. It's the reason why you're going to buy the book, because you flip it open and you're caught by the imagery and maybe, going back to the word, the leader, you know, what caught your attention on that spread. And it's going to be then the story behind, you know, the nice jacket that you see on the rail. Oh, it's from a brand in Munich, and I want to know more about them. I've never heard about them, and what is their story? So it is, yeah, to me, it is about the story, and it has to be underpinned by quality. It has to be, there has to be a slight, you know, rarity to it. I mean, not to totally play on one of the codes of luxury, but there has to be a scarcity to it as well. I mean, I do want you to go to Charles de Gaulle and find the magazine always. So it shouldn't be that scarce, but there are levels to it. I mean, of course, the magazine should always be available, but I think when we think about other things, it's okay that there's a limited number of tickets to an event. It's good to be sold out. And because that was a moment in time and you missed it and you weren't there in the moment. And the same thing that fantastic new sweatshirt that we've made in the north of Portugal, you know, we're not doing that again. And we only did 400 of them, and you have to get in line for the next one.
Let's talk the second one. Yeah. There's so many.
Sell. Well, I mean, we're not going to make money if we don't sell. I'm going to pick another one. Influence. I think that, again, I don't think it's a driving force to get out of bed every day, but it's great to be, recognized when you do have a level of influence on the retail landscape, or when you have influence going back to things that we write about, things that we say, people that we interview have, become part of and set a certain agenda for whether it's change in cities, or the influence that we might have on other media as well. I mean, sometimes it's annoying to see that people copy your font, or they, but yeah.
It's you copied a lot?
There's a magazine in France that's out there, which looks very familiar to us still. But we don't need to name it on air. I've got to repeat. I'm still looking through the pile here. We have the word sell again. Survive. Yeah, of course, we have to wake up every single day. And, you know, some days it is more about survival. And there's been some dark moments over the past few years when it was very tough in the pandemic period. But also the opposite allowed us to, you know, survival also allowed us to thrive in many ways, certainly in the medium that we're standing here in front of two microphones at the moment. It allowed certainly the audio aspect of our business to completely amp up in a very, very different way. It forced us to stand up. I mean, as we're discussing, you know, this idea of running to the fire. I'm going through this pile because I think we should we should be complete. Happiness.
Are you happy?
I'm happy. I'm generally always quite happy, but I'm probably the wrong person to ask. But I'm an optimist, and I think optimists tend to be quite happy. So I'm always, and of course, I mean, I can get in a foul mood, but I move on very fast. I don't stay in a dark place very, very long. It's hopefully it can be measured in minutes, not hours. And it's interesting. This is I pulled up the last word. I read reliant, and I thought it was a spelling mistake in French, but it's relevant.
Relevant. Reliant. We can talk about both.
Maybe you have to be reliant to also to be relevant, but. Sure, and I think relevance comes in sort of peaks and valleys. Maybe sometimes you're within the cultural landscape, you are more relevant than you are at other times. Competition and the forces of the day take you somewhere else, and take your business somewhere else. And maybe you're not as relevant, and you feel that sometimes you're like, okay, what we are and the framework of our of who we are editorially is right for the moment. Our message is very clear. The city is in focus, or because of our commitment to Japan, and there's a Japan moment. We're in it, or we're relevant because we gave that attention to Korea, and sometimes, of course, you can be a bit wide of the mark as well. But I think that. Quality always wins, and I believe that and it's sadly it's not always widespread where quality wins, but I think there's a recognition if you're out there and you are you're witness to the story and you're working with the best talent or the most interesting emerging talent and I go back to that point about just you are physically in the world, then I think there's a relevance because it shows an engagement, it shows a curiosity, and I think that makes you relevant because we are in a time where there is less investment in going out in the world. It's easier to just to research. Across a desktop, or to research from your armchair on your phone, and to hear it secondhand from someone who is there, when maybe it would have been wiser to send one of your own people, or work with a trusted source in that corner of the world. And I think that more than ever is going to make us relevant.
Fantastic. One last question to close the interview is who would you like to listen to in this podcast?
Who would I like to listen to? I would like to hear from maybe like three people. I gave you a hint with one already. I would love to hear Ben Smith, so the head of Air France KLM, I think would be very interesting because we've been talking about also the power of being present and being out there in the world, and here's someone who's serving one of, of course, he's running one of the biggest airlines in the world, but he's running it out of Paris, and the role that Paris and France plays economically and culturally in the world, and I think the power that an airline has today as well at a time when, of course, France has been putting forth a lot of legislation which makes it. Which raises question marks around airlines and is it right to fly, etc. And but of course I'm a big defender and believe that we need to get out in the world and airlines do serve a purpose. So I'd like to hear from Ben Smith. I'd love to hear from the one of the Dassault family. I'd like to certainly someone who looks after the media interests of Dassault and Le Figaro and maybe their commitment as to why they believe that they should still have a media brand. And I think it would just be interesting to also hear from a company which is in media but also owns one of the world's biggest defense companies. So they don't all have to be French. I would like to hear you interview someone who we respect a lot, but I think with a French accent and a French lens, I think Emma Tucker would be great for a program like this as well, with her new seat at the Wall Street Journal.
Fantastic. Did you like it?
I loved it. It was great.
Yeah. Thank you so much again for your warm welcome and goodbye.
Merci. Thank you.
And long life to Monocle.
Thank you.
My name is Adrien Garcia, and you've just listened to The Bold Way. find this episode in text and pictures at theboldway.fr. The Bold Way is where creativity and innovation meets business. Thank you for your trust and see you soon for a new episode.